Blog Talk Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، الرحمن الرحيم، مالك يوم الدين، إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين، اهدنا الصراط المستقيم، صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. آمين.
You're listening to American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice protected.
Community-wide Shura and AM 360 invite you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event to strengthen our national intelligentsia and network. Contact underwriting today at cwsconline@gmail.com. That's cwsconline@gmail.com. Or call 910-317-0297. 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake this world into a better place.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance.
I sound like God Monday morning. Sister. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, I'm good. How are you doing?
Alhamdulillah. On the right side of the world this morning. So I'm doing just well. So I believe our brother Fleming is somewhere on the motherland this week. Is that correct?
Is that this week,
madam?
Is it this week or next week?
It might be okay. Next week. He might be preparing for his big trip to Ghana.
Alhamdulillah.
So we have a fantastic show planned today, and we're going to continue from last week's show. And I did want you to give people a wrap-up of what happened last week, but before we do that, I just want to take a couple of minutes because the show is so hot today and it's so timely in dealing with what's getting ready to happen for a lot of parents. This time of year always reminds me of that commercial, the most wonderful time of the year. And not Christmas, none of that. And a whole bunch of parents skipping through the streets, getting the children out of their house and dancing around. But when I see that commercial, sister, I know you have children too, so I always think they cannot be real parents. Real parents know that it's not that wonderful. You're like losing your mind trying to get them back into school. And, you know, between trying to find the right, you know, I don't want that backpack. Right, I don't want that backpack. I don't want that lunchbox. There's not the right notebook. And you can't find that. You never find the right list for which school supplies. And it's different in the from K through third, and it is 4 through 6, and it is the middle school, and it is for high school. And it seems like they torture you every year because the school supply sale goes on 1 week, and then the week after the school supply sale goes on, that's when they release the list of the things that you need. So the sale and the list, they never coincide. So, you know, so no, it's no wonderful. It's not a wonderful time. And but this week, we just like last week, we're going to talk about the things that they don't tell you that's needed in that backpack, right? And the social emotional content that's needed in that backpack for both the child and the parent. But before we do that, there's a couple of things that happened around the world. Spain pulled off an exciting thriller in the Women's World Cup and won, the improbable winner of that. And, you know, we're still deep grappling with what's happening in Hawaii, which is, been a heartbreaker.
Yeah. It's a difficulty to ease.
Yes. We've got, you know, we've got drilling down in Ecuador that is sparking not only controversy, but that has been causing even more climate issues down there. We still have the horrific wars going on in the Middle East and parts of what we call MENA, Middle East and North Africa, that is causing not only strife from the war itself, but the outcome of it in the starvation of people. So the economic outfall of that is harming human beings, and we don't see the same outpouring of support for that region that we see for other regions that are not in the MENA region, more so in the European region. We see lots of support going, monetary and humanitarian support. So we are at a crossroads coming in the world on who deserves. The conversation has been who deserves humanitarian support. Sister, what are you seeing?
Well, everyone does, but we know that it's not distributed equally. Based on what's that catchphrase they use, our strategic interests. So, you know, systemic racism is a part of that also, as well as the same amount of media coverage is not given to those parts of the world that corporate media has been told does not meet our strategic interests until it spills over to where Americans are directly impacted either through death or financial loss. So people just thought we have to broaden our scope of the media that we pay attention to and the media outlets that we subscribe to so that we can get a more, for lack of a better word, holistic or a broader sense of what's going on in the world.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that's a part of it.
And that's where it becomes imperative that we have our own media sources. With that,
yes,
I do want to move really quickly into our show. We do have some, because it's education season, we have some educators on who are, guess what, they're also back in school. So we're gonna be shuffling into them because today's show we have the Honorable Jamila Smith Bowles, who's an educator and trustee with the West Contra Costa Unified School District. I'm gonna introduce her in a moment, more on her bio. We have Sister Aliyah Akbar, honorable in of her own rights, with the Oakland Unified School District, a school psychologist will be talking to her. And then he will be logging on shortly. We have Brother Hank, who will be coming on. Hank Roberts will be coming on with the Peacemakers Project and also the California-Hawaii NAACP Parent Engagement Committee will be talking to us in a little bit. But first, I wanted you to, I know we have some technical issues nationwide with Blog Talk, and we had a fabulous show last week. Can you just take a few minutes to key us up to this second part of Back to School, Back to Work, Back to Learning? What we'll be talking about today kind of comes as a part two to what happened last week. So can you bring us up to speed before we bring on our guests today? Tell us what happened last week.
Sure.
Yes. Thank you.
We did it through an actual Zoom meeting where we had two college students, Zainat Islam and Jabril Reen. Jabril will be going into his first year at Long Island University. Zaina will be returning for her second year at Morgan State. And they shared with us, in Jabril's case, he has an older brother, Umi, who went to the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And so Umi was able to share with Jabril some of those minor details that you don't really think about when you're going off to school, but once you get there, you realize that they are important details. And then just some of the anxiety that he might have over expectations, thinking about how he has to learn how to manage his time, the time management, and also the independence that the freshman student has to take on. It's a whole different mindset from high school because there are no truant officers or counselors or somebody who's going to alert to your parents that you're not going to classes. It's all on you. Zaina shared with us, now both of these are California students going back to the East Coast, so the adjustment you have to make as far as your living conditions, the climate, how the climate affects the clothes that you need to deal with the colder weather in the winter. Also living in a dorm, the adjustment you have to make, excuse me, based on how many dorm mates that you have. So they had some very practical questions and situations that they shared with us. Zaina also mentioned getting adjusted to the presentation styles of different professors when you go for your college courses. You know, especially first and second year students, if you go to a big university or college, you might be in a seminar room with 200 students if it's a core class, core curriculum. or 70, you know. And so there's an adjustment that you have to make, and you have to be able to distinguish yourself among the students in your cohort. And so we also stress to them the importance of making sure you sign up for office hours and going to office hours so that your professor becomes engaged with you on a personal level, as far as knowing that you are trying to engage with the materials that are being presented, and how you have to also overcome shyness or the effects of what they call imposter syndrome, you know, that people have when they get into spaces that they may be the only one. They may be the only African-American in a particular class, or maybe it's only three or four in a class of 200 or 300. So those kinds of issues, adjusting to meal plans that you have on campus. And Brother Hank shared with us an important factor to consider, especially those who are going back for their sophomore year. And all of the students should really consider this, because we know the thrust with the voter suppression movement. They really have young voters in their sights as far as suppressing that vote. So students who may be out-of-state students, if you are in your second, your third, or your fourth year, you should, from a financial perspective also, after that first year, establish residence in that state where you'll be going to school. You get the benefit of in-state tuition, which in 99.9% of the time is significantly cheaper than out-of-state tuition. So we talked about that as far as from the student's perspective. From the parent and the general citizen perspective, in the pre-K through K system, the idea of the difference between parental activity and parental engagement. And the engagement is really that empowerment piece where parents actually have a say in what is going on at the school that their child is attending. And what gives them that say is if they have a voice, either themselves or a representative, that is a part of the school site council. And we learned that that school site council is a critical piece in determining resources, curriculum, activities, just every budget allocations, everything that goes on at that school. And so rather than merely having the principal to decide these things, the parents and those community members who are active with the school site council can collaborate and work with designing what is going to happen at that school. Do we need more resources in the area of IEP resources? Do we need more resources in the area of tutoring? You know, so all of those kinds of considerations as far as what really is going to make the school work. And so we also had Sister Zelon Harrison on, who was one of the co-founders of the Black Parents Resource Center. And so her group provides counseling and education and resources for parents to help them to become more engaged, as opposed to just engaging in the activities of the school, like the football games, basketball games, you know, PTA meetings. All of that is good, but we want parents to have more of a voice, especially since California is going to this community school model, which we have to learn more of, and the legislature passed laws that hopefully by 2031, there's been budget allocation and planning to bring these community school models into existence so that at least one out of three of every school in the state of California will be on that community model framework. And to do that, parents really have to be engaged, because that community model school, the design of it is to present resources and partnerships that will focus on the academics, the health, the social services, and youth and community development. So community engagement, parental engagement is really key in this, what California has as the California Community School Partnership Program. So there was a lot of information that we were able to cover last week. Hopefully we'll be able to get the recording of the program on the community-wide SURE platform for MAP 5, so that parents at their leisure can go back and listen to the information that was shared. All in all, I think I know the two students, Zaina and Jabril, they expressed gratitude at the tip that Brother Hank and Sister Zaman shared with them as they look forward to their university life. And hopefully parents who listen to the program, because the school site councils are not limited to just California. This is a structure that's all over the United States. And we hear a lot about the school boards and all of the commotions and the chaos that organizations like Moms for Liberty and whatnot are causing at the school board level. But we don't hear about the school site councils. That's where the rubber meets the road, and that's where I would encourage, particularly Muslim parents, if you have children in public schools, there's no Clara Muhammad school or any kind of Islamic madrasa school in your area, and your children, if you're not homeschooling them, but they have to go to the public school, then we need to be at the school site council meetings, and we need to have an active voice in that so that we get what we need for our children in the public school system. So that's my recap. I hope it was helpful.
Thank you so much. Yes, it was. Thank you so much. So with that, let's move. I want to move straight into talking about, because that was really helpful. Thank you. That'll help frame what I want to talk about today, because what we spend a lot of time talking about, especially when we go, when we talk about back to school, I think parents get so worn out by the time summer's over that all we think about is the perfunctory part of back to school. You know, we spend a whole lot of time, I don't know how many, seen, and we spend so much time worrying about, you know, the traditional school supplies, backpacks and pens and pencils and rulers and compasses and notebooks and things of that nature. And then we go and we spend a grip on like new clothes, and we take our children from store to store buying the right, the so-called quote-unquote right clothes and shoes, and making sure we have the food for the nutritious food for their lunches and their snacks. And then those who can't afford it or don't want to, you know, we have all these backpack giveaways. And then you have a sale. If you turn on your television, you can't, or you open your mailbox, you cannot get away with seeing the ads for the sales and the clothes. And everybody's talking about, you know, Healthy California, they've got a commercial out every 5 minutes about making sure you put healthy snacks in their lunches. And the new school year is approaching, but nobody's talking about making sure that our children and our students and our families are ready for this psychological warfare, as you just spoke about, that's happening in our classroom. And no one is talking about the other hidden darkness in the room, that there's crime happening every time you walk down the street. So a lot of these children are walking to school or riding to school on public transit or parents dropping them off, and they're seeing what's happening on their way to school. So a lot of them are traumatized before they even enter the classroom by the very real circumstances of life in their neighborhoods, or we can call them circumstances, or sometimes we call them consequences, of life in their neighborhoods and sometimes in their own homes. And so while it's great that they have this pretty backpack, what is really in their other bag? What is happening in the back that the backpack is going on? And then they go from, you know, first and to third grade and fourth to sixth grade, and then their bodies are changing, their lives are changing, where they move from one part of school to the next, and now they have to deal with things like harassment and bullying, whether it's in person or cyber, and this is students and teachers. And then we have this ongoing battle between the state and the schools and the parents and the activism. What are you going to teach my children, and why aren't you teaching them that, and what information can we share, and when can you share it, and how are the children going to learn it, and what can they not learn, and what books can they take, and what books can they not take, and what websites can they access, and what websites can they not access, and how much time are we really preparing them and ourselves to be mentally and emotionally prepared for not just school, because it doesn't just stop just because they get out of class on June whatever. And you can't just put an apple in their back, in their lunchbox, and put on a really cute outfit and say, go ahead, everything is ready to go. I want to introduce you to a couple of people so we can get this conversation started. Miss Jamila Smith Foltz, born raised, born and reared, I should say. My grandmother hates that word, raised. Born and reared in Alabama. I went to Auburn. Of course she did. And she's a girl mom. Three daughters. Her and her husband come here from Alabama. She's a middle school. Her middle child is a 10th grader. And her youngest is a 5th grader. And her oldest is heading off to Brown pretty soon, in a couple of weeks. She's been an educator for over 15 years, and she's been with the West Contra Costa Unified School District for the past three. And she's a teacher, a parent volunteer, a community advocate. She's not just a teacher, she's an educator. And she has this really bold commitment to just being authentic and unapologetic about her commitment to honest, forthright education of our children, not just teaching them, but educating them. Welcome to the show, Honorable Jamila Smith-Foltz.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes madam. We can.
Well,
yes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank
you so much.
We are so honored to have you here. I love your approach to teaching. You have this way of speaking that affords every child this ability to learn in a way that they need to learn and that their needs have to be met. Talk to us about some of the things you've heard that children, you know, need and that some of these children spoke of last week, especially some of the college students, and you heard how we approached, how they were speaking of approaching, you know, college and things like that. But the mom, as an elementary, middle school, or not middle school, high schooler, and now an approaching college student and an educator, talk to us about what needs to be in that backpack, because you're really good at this social-emotional learning thing. Talk to us about what you see, and you're on the board. So you see it from this whole top eagle-eye view. Talk to us
about
what parents might be missing.
Thank you for that. I think that you hit the head on the nail. It's one of those things that we can sign our children up, but if we don't give them the stuff that they need to be able to make it through. So every year in my child's backpack, no matter what stage or age they are, there is an informational sheet for my child, because if they get into an emergency and they get under stress, they need to know my name, my phone number, my email address, their, and this is at every stage, because stress and tension, it gets you, and you start forgetting things. As an adult, if we were under a high degree of stress, we would forget something if somebody asked us. So that's in their backpack. That's in their backpack because what if there's an earthquake or a shelter in place or something, and someone can't get to the office or get to the emergency bag, their backpack's usually always with them. So they always have that. So they have, again, address, phone number, my email address, way to get in touch with their dad, their emergency contact, their first, second, and third emergency contact, and then they have a little note from me at the bottom. Stay calm. It's okay. I got you. I will be there as soon as possible. You don't have to worry. Whatever's happening, I'm going to come to you, right? And then they have on the very bottom of that, if someone asks you a question, you say, call my mama. if you think that you need something, it's call my mama. That's all you have to say, call my mama, and then they will find my number and they will call me. You don't have to feel trapped or interrogated or pushed to the side or intimidated, any of that. Call my mama. If it's outside of your comfort zone, call my mama. That's all you have to remember. That's real easy, and we practice it. We practice that over and over again, call my mama. I also, for my elementary school and my high schooler has an IEP, which is an individual education plan. So she gets a letter that each one of her teachers, that she hands out to each one of her teachers. Hi, my name is so-and-so. This is what my IEP says, because an IEP is a legal document. This is what my IEP says. This is my accommodations. This is what's going to happen. These are my clues to where, you know, I'm about to get up and walk out of class because I need a brain break. This is what this is. No one should tell you about your child. You should tell them about your child, right? So I give my children agency and voice, whether they can say it or they can show it. So if you can say it, say it. If you can show it, give every teacher that piece of paper. For my elementary school daughter, she only has one teacher. So I go up to that teacher. I introduce myself. I let them know this is my child. I let them know this is who she is. This is what she does. So if they call me and tell me so-and-so did this, nope, that's not my child. I know my child's not going to do that because I told you what my child's going to do. Now, does that mean the teacher is lying? Nope. That teacher may have just mistaken something else, and I will come up there and I will ask the teacher and I will ask my child, but we are going to sit down and have a whole roundtable conversation, because you're not going to put something on my kid that I know is not my kid. Now, that means that, listen, my name is not Mary. My children are not Jesus. I will tell you exactly what they will and will not do. I don't have that fake idea that my children walk telling you what I know they would do and what I know they will not do. So these are things that I like to have that wraparound services.
I think that's really important. So I want to emphasize that. And so I want you to focus on it just for a moment, because I think that's really, really important. I know I did this for my children and I got it from my mom doing it for me. So I wanted to kind of focus on that for a moment and see if that's something that you learned, if you learned, you discovered it, or how you got to that point, because my mother did that for all of us. I just distinctly remember her coming up to the school and talking to each one of the teachers and saying, you know, if she gets bored, she's not going to talk to you. If this one starts acting up, you need to give him some more work. And she did it for each teacher and at the very beginning of the school year. And I remember for each of my children, I did the same thing. So tell us some pointers and how important it is to establish that relationship with each teacher for each child at the very beginning before there's an issue, and in how, what pointer for these parents you can give to them and how they can do it, especially if they're not feeling comfortable. Because like you say, we know our children, and we know they are not, they do not have wings sprouting out of their back. So, you know, he's not always a teacher, because I know if you come and tell me, yeah, that sound like him, or that's not him, or there's no her. So what gave you that?
My mom my dad did it for us, because my mom and my dad, we were raised or reared in Alabama. So there was no one for us but us. So when we went to a school and there was nothing but white teachers, my parents were very clear to walk in that classroom and say, this is my child. I know my child, and I'm watching you watch them. So be careful and understand that I'm their advocate. My parents were our advocate, my brother and I's advocate, from the very beginning. You had to know that they were for you. My parents were for us. But they also said, you better have clean hands. Because if I get in there and they tell me something that you didn't tell me, you're going to get it when you get home. So don't have me coming up here looking like a fool, because I'm backing you up. And then you done come up here and did some kind of crazy at the schoolhouse. So it was very clear. But it was not a divide and conquer. When something happened, my parent, well, I'll tell you an example. When I was in second grade, my teacher said that I had to go to special ed. My daddy said, not my child. What are you talking about? The teacher said, well, she's not doing any of the work. And my daddy said, I don't care what she's not doing for you. She knows how to do this. So this is a you issue. How are you not reaching my child? And the teacher said, well, she's just not paying attention. She's just not doing the work. And he said, not my child. She'll pay attention. If she's not doing the work, it's something else. My dad said, what have you tried? And the teacher said, you know, well, I'll just tell her to do the work. He said, what have you tried? Well, I just tell her to do the work. Where is she sitting in the classroom? Well, she's sitting all the way in the back. Well, why is she sitting all the way in the back? Do you have a roster to where you put them in alphabetical order? No, I don't have a roster. But then why did you put my child in the back? This went on and on and on for a couple of weeks. And then they had the vision people come to the school. Well, I needed glasses. Sitting all the way in the back.
There you go.
I couldn't see. I didn't know it, but my daddy knew that this narrative that this teacher was putting on me wasn't true. He was like, you have to figure something out, because that's not it. I don't know what it is, but I know that's not it. So if you don't know who your kid is, know who they're not. You got to tell, if you can't tell the teacher who your kid is, tell the teacher who your kid isn't. My kid is not going to take no guess. My kid is not going to steal. My kid is not going to do this. My kid is not going to put their hands on somebody unless they put their hands on them. Tell these people who your children are so they will understand. And then you make them explain to you at every level what happened. Document, document, document. If you call me into that office and you're saying that my child got into a fight, you tell me everything that happened. I want to see it. I want to see the write-up. Show me the witnesses. Show me the write-up. You show me what happened, because my child knows that they don't put their hands on somebody. But this is home rearing, too. You got to be confident. Now, if you let Billy run around like he lost his mind at home, don't be surprised if he loses his mind in the schoolhouse. He's going to lose his mind there, too, because there's no normalcy for him. What you do at home is what shows up in the world. So you have to have a level of accountability also. But for my children, say it or show it. So for parents, say it. Go right up to them teachers and say, hi, my name is Miss Jones. This is how you get in contact with me. This is my child. This is my expectation. This is my expectation for my child. This is what I expect to see them have. And this is who you can expect to see show up in your classroom every day. They're going to have a tablet charge. They're going to have a pencil. They're going to have a pen. They're going to have paper. They're going to be fed. They're going to sit down. They're going to listen. They're going to pay attention. But when they raise their hand, I'm going to need you to focus on them, because they want to be able to say what they know. They like to say what they know. Or if they have a problem, they will tell you. But they're not just going to come to you with everything. So when they do come to you, make sure you pay attention to them, because they're going to tell me everything when they get home. As soon as my child hits that car door, I'm asking them, tell me about your day. And then I'm prompting them questions. Well, what happened? What did you learn? What did the teacher say? Do you have any problems today? Did you have some joys today? What was the thorns? What were the roses? You have to be able to be that person for 13 years and then be that person on the phone when they go to college or career. That's your job. You're a parent. You have to prepare them.
It's the job. It's the parent. It's the parent. It's the parent.
Yeah, can I interject?
Go ahead.
I think it's another element. The reality of the economics, there are many parents who might be working two or three jobs, or may have large families, 4, 5, 6 children, and they may not be able to give the level of focus and interaction with the teachers that Sister Jamila is talking about. Is there another mechanism in the school system where there can be another advocate for the child? Does it only have to be the parent? Can there also be what are deemed educational advocates for children?
There doesn't always have to be the parent. My parents both worked. I was a latchkey kid, right? My parents both worked, but they made that sacrifice, and it is a sacrifice at the beginning of the year, either to write it down or to go talk to each of the teachers. The other thing is when you get this community school model, right, when we focus and drill down on what the school model is, then you can also have the SCOW, the school community outreach workers. Then you have the parent volunteer. If you can't be there, when I went to college, the first people my mama introduced me to was all of the secretaries and all of the departments and the custodians. She did that when I was in high school, too, because those are the people that are there every day and the ones that are going to take care of you. If you can't have your mama on campus every day, you need to have a mama fiduciary on campus every day, and that's not always the teacher. So you get to know that custodian. You get to know that librarian. You get to know that your food service worker. You get to know the secretary, and you say, this one's mine. If you need me, call me. In my phone right now, I have more parents' phone numbers in my phone than anyone else because they know that I'm on campus. So you have to build your village. It's not going to come to you. You have to go out and build that village to protect your child. That's still your child. And it's still your accountability and responsibility, and it's a sacrifice. And when you have an older sibling, get that older sibling badge so they can come into the school. If you have a child in your house right now that is 18 years or older, get them badge so they can come to the district school. And all they got to do is they can come in and sight. If you have a grandma, a TT, an uncle, a cousin, a community member that you want to have that fiduciary responsibility of your child, get them badge and put them on the emergency card. You put them on that emergency card in West Contra-Costa Unified School District, they stand in place of you as a parent. So the school can contact them and you can pick that child up. You can take that child out of school. You can do all these things that parents do. So the parents have to figure out how to build that village. But those are just some of the ways of doing it. Some of the ways of building that village are the ones that I just listed. I hope that answers the question a little bit.
That answered the question. Yeah. Also, do you know other resources that help to empower parents to get that kind of knowledge of how do I build this village? Who can I go to or where can I go to get this kind of information?
So in West Contra Costa, the school board is supposed to be the navigators. So any parent in West Contra Costa can come to me and ask me, and I will give them that same information and help them navigate it. I will help them get badges. I will help them get their community badge, and I will help them build their individual child's village, right? Their individual child's village around them. And it's one of those things that, especially if you're kindergarten or if you're fourth grade and you've never done it before, it's something that you have to be guided through. It's not something that you can just kind of do, but you have to be guided through. So I'm willing to do that with any parent, guardian, sibling, child, student themselves. Because my children themselves, they know their rights. No teacher going to put their hands on my child. My children know their rights. They know that you, again, call my mama. They know that no one is going to call them into the principal's office without me being in there. No, ma'am, I will not go into the principal's office without my mama. Please call my mama. Those are things that the kids know their rights to. My daughter who has the IEP, she's a special ed lawyer. She knows every ed code that goes along with her IEP, and she knows everything that she's supposed to be able to say to that teacher or a substitute about what her accommodations and her modifications are. Teach your children to advocate for themselves also. They're in this system for 13 years, and they're in this system for 8 hours, for 180 days, for 13 years. They have to be equipped with their voice.
Thank you.
So with that, there's five things, and I wanted you to touch. That was a good one, because that was one of the ones I wanted you to touch on, is the self-advocacy. And the other ones, there was five things, and I love it, because there was you, and I want you to talk about the series, because I know you have to go at 11 or before 11. And you started the series on Facebook, which, you know, I follow it. adulting for your daughter getting ready to go away. But before that, there's five things that I wanted to touch on that we are trying to teach our children when it comes to social emotional learning. Self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision-making. And then the sixth one is the self-advocacy. And all six of those are also things that parents need to learn, right? So not only are the parents learning, it's our families learning this, but the children, these are things that children need to learn as well. So I wanted to just spend a couple of minutes talking about crucial things from social emotional context that everybody needs to learn in order for families and students to excel outside of the academic realm, but that totally affects their ability to academically excel. But I also wanted to just dispel one thing. All of us, and I know some parents don't like hearing this, all of us, and I love that you said it's work. Parenting is work, and all of us make sacrifices. And all of us have to make decisions when we become parents. And one of the hardest decisions to make is to put your children first. And there's a decision that you make. It was a very hard decision to leave my job and to take a different job with a 60% pay cut. But it was the best decision I ever made, just to focus on my children. And 60% is hard to make up with one person in a household. I mean, my husband was there, but he couldn't make up 60% of the salary. But it was the best decision ever that I ever made, because just watching my children know that I'm there in the stands, I'm there when they do something, it's a good decision. Not everybody has that option to make it, but there is a decision that you make. So, Jamila, there's six of them. Advocacy, self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and the responsible decision-making. I wanted to see if you wanted to talk about those.
So in most of the six that you said, and then in three of the six that you said, and the other three is inferred, self. Should I own self be true? You have to know who you are. You have to be. You have to be self-confident. You have to be self-aware. You have to be a self-advocate. You have to be able to say, this is who I am and this is what I need. And with little kids, you just give them prompts. My youngest daughter says, or my middle daughter says all the time, I need a brain break, right? That means she needs to go by herself. She needs to isolate for a minute. She needs to get recharged. My oldest knows she's an introvert. She knew that from the very beginning. Please don't call on me when I have my hand up. I want to be able to speak. She knows who she is. My youngest is an extrovert. She knows when to rein it in. You're at a 10, I'm going to need you to bring it down to a 5. Like, she has that self-awareness. She understands her meter inside of her. But that's because it was modeled in front of her. How much emotional intelligence do the parents have? Right? What are you modeling for your children? If you throw a fit, don't think they're not going to throw a fit. If you advocate
right.
for yourself this way, then they're going to advocate for themselves. If you let somebody run over you, they're going to let somebody run over them. Children are little models. They watch what you do more than they listen to what you say. So parents, you need to act the way you want them to be, and then they will be the way that you act. You have to do that. You have to do that. Now, they will cling on to some of these teachers, and they'll cling to other these people, but that's your child. You, when they have to write an essay about who is their greatest role model or their greatest influence, your name should always be top four. Your name should be top four. If it's not, you're not doing what you need to be doing. I want to be top two, God and me. That's how I want to be in my kid. If you're writing about who you need to model after, it's God and then it's me. Because that's the level of influence that I put inside of them. We have to know just how powerful we are to our children, whether you only are there for dinner time, my parents both work two jobs, or whether you're there for breakfast, yeah. lunch, dinner, snack, and you go on the field trip. Whatever level of engagement you are with your child, you have to know that you are their primary modeler. You model it. So you have to figure out very clearly who you want them to be, and you need to start modeling that. If you want them to be self-aware, be self-aware. If you want them to be self-advocate, be a self-advocate. If you want them to have self-confidence, have self-confidence. If you want them, you have to do that. They are your gift from God. Don't mess it up. Don't mess it up. You have to be able to do that. Listen, I gave my kids everything I didn't have, but I forgot to teach them everything I was taught. And now I'm rushing to the finish line. Now, my 10-year-old is better than my 18-year-old because I learn quickly. I'm not a slow learner. I learn quickly. Okay, come on. I'm going to teach you how to cook. Come on. I'm going to teach you how to clean this room. Come on. I'm going to teach you how to plunge this toilet. Come on. Because I was so busy giving that oldest one, that first one, everything I didn't have, that I forgot to teach her everything that I was taught. And I didn't make that mistake with my second, and I didn't make that mistake with my third. But that first one, that's where those adulting lessons are coming from. Come on, we got to open this bank account. Come on, you got to learn how to do this. Come on, but see, she's a smart kid, so she can pick it up quickly. But we have to understand our role in these kids' lives. And they're just given to us. They're gifts. Sooner or later, we got to give them back. We got to give them back in different forms, and it looks differently, but we got to give them back.
Sister, let me ask you a question.
go ahead. One thing that I have found in the last 2 or 3 years is, and this is true of California for our listening audience, people who may be in other parts of the country, this may or may not be true. I'm not sure. It depends on what the flow of immigration has been in your particular state. The area I want to look at is, we've been talking about the parent-to-child relationship, but there's also a dynamic of the peer-to-peer dynamic of your child with their classmates. And in some of the classes, there's such a diversity of children coming from other countries and who have had other experiences. You know, you have some children have come from countries that are war-torn countries, and so that has had a psychological impact on the students. Some of them may have come from refugee camps. Some of them may have lost one or both parents. And so you have all of those dynamics. Do you have any suggestions for parents to help prepare their child to relate to their classmates and to be empathetic? They don't have to get all in their business, but just to be empathetic, student to student, so that we can cut down on bullying and miscommunication and this kind of gang kind of mentality also. Do you have any suggestion for parents in that vein?
I think one of the things that we should continue to do and we need to do is mainstream children together. Experience and exposure creates empathy. So it's one of those things that if we isolate children, right, then we're not going to let them replicate the real world. The real world is not isolated. When you go to work, you work with people who have all different experiences and all different stories and come with all different traumas. The other thing is if you don't have trauma-enforced teaching to where they can recognize that and then they can set their classroom up as a space of safety, then that's a problem. For parents, you have to be able – listen, if you live in a neighborhood where everybody looks like you, I need you to go to another neighborhood on the weekend. And I need you to intentionally put your children around people who are not like you. I need you to go to a church, synagogue, or some type of place of worship. I need you to go to a farmer's market. I need you to get out and you intentionally put yourself in situations where you have to have engagement and relationships with other people because, again, it's about are you training your child for the skills they're going to need for the world. This country does not look like the world. This country looks like the way it was wanted to be built. This is the way this country intended itself to be built. But if you look at it, we are – Black and brown people are part of the global majority. We're part of the global majority. Now, it is by design that you can go some places in the country, in the United States of America, and find just pockets of white. That's by design. But what we as people black and brown people of color need to do is we need to insist on cultural competency in our schools. We need to insist on that we have what is the real global majority be reflected in our schools. One of the issues we have is that we have black and brown children in a system that's still taught by a majority of white people. If your child don't have somebody in front of them that looks like them or is on the same site as them, they're going to feel isolated because they're only going to see themselves at home. If they don't see themselves in books and in teachers and in programs and in activities and in field trips and in recess games and in all the other things, if they don't see themselves, they're going to feel outcast. So that's a responsibility of the district. That's a responsibility of the school board. That's a responsibility of principals. And it's a responsibility of parents. Bring your culture to the school. There is a difference between assimilation and association. Bring your whole authentic self and your child's whole authentic self to the school. They're going to have to be stronger than most, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible for them to do it. It's one of those things that it can happen. It can happen. When I was in school, we had a child who was from China. He wore a traditional Chinese garb every day. And then we got curious. What's that? What are you doing? What's happening? What's wrong? Kids are naturally curious. What we want to do is prevent them from being naturally mean. And that means that we've got teachers engaging students. That means we have teachers who are intentionally stopping and learning how to pronounce your child's name. They are learning how to pronounce their name. They're learning what their traditional outfit looks like. They're asking questions in front of the class. They're bringing snacks that your child would like to eat, too, and introducing it to the school, into the classroom. You're doing it as a parent. Hey, these are traditional baklava. This is baklava. This is what it is. I want the kids to try it. This is what we eat at home every day. This is traditional this, or this is what we eat here, or this is what we do here. When I taught school, I brought my children in some real Southern food, real Southern food. They ain't never had macaroni and cheese like I brought them in because it's different food. And I brought them in some hush puppies and told them the story behind hush puppies and some fried catfish and told them the story behind it. Now, they've had it here, but they've had it with a different twist to it. I said, well, this is from the South. This is what this looks like. Let me tell you about my culture. Let me tell you what it means. Let me tell you where it came from. Let me tell you what the influence is. Let me tell you how it's connected to Africa. Let me tell you. So if we have an attitude of let me tell you, let me show you, let me let you be with me, then it creates that empathy. But again, parents, let's go. You're involved. Community, let's go. You're involved. We have a beautiful Haitian community. Okay, let's go. Let's get into it. Let's bring some of this to the school, to the schoolhouse. This is your place of education, and everybody should be welcome and feel welcome. And if you don't, get comfortable making people uncomfortable, because I love that too. Get comfortable making people uncomfortable, and then we move forward. I hope that answers the question a little bit.
It does. I noticed that we have a couple of hands up, so there might be a few more questions before you leave. But thank you. That was great. That was great.
Yeah, I know you have to go, but can you take maybe one question, Sister Jamila?
Absolutely. I'm still waiting for the superintendent. He hadn't showed up yet, so I'm good.
Okay, so let's see if we can get a question or two in. Okay, let's see who this is. Caller 5638, can you state your question? Brevity
yeah,
would be
you.
Good because we got to let the sister go. Tell us where you're from, your name
you
and where you're from.
Ishmael
Absolutely.
Family, Dallas, Texas. Enjoying
us. Hi, Ishmael, brother Ishmael.
Yes,
Thank you.
Man, this
question?
Conversation is great.
Thank you.
Everything, just real quickly, my daughter, my youngest, we tried to do everything right. So she my wife was able to take care of her until pre-K. And from pre-K to eighth grade, she worked in the school with my daughter. So it was real, you know, it was a real hands-on experience. My daughter enjoyed it. COVID came. So seventh and eighth grade, part of seventh and eighth grade year, she didn't, you know, they weren't in school. So it was a big thing. So come ninth grade, she was fine. Her 10th grade year, she ended up having some gastrointestinal issues where she had to be out for like a month. And so come this year, she wants to be homeschooled. And I always grew up letting my children be able to articulate themselves. My wife was kind of old school, you do what I say, so it was kind of a balance, you know. But she's articulating why she wants to be homeschooled in a way that, you know, she's saying, you know, she still has these stomach issues and she doesn't like to you know, my wife doesn't, you know, she works at a different school now. She doesn't like to have my mother or my mother-in-law pick her up. And she's like saying, school, homeschooling would be better for me. And she's in a collegiate, a small collegiate class where she's going to get her associate's once she graduates. So we're in the position where I'm like, I want her to go to school, but I also want to be an advocate for her homeschooling. She feels that's what's best because she's been taught to articulate herself. My wife wants her to stay in school, and we're just kind of at a pinpoint. And my question is, I think it comes down when kids socialize. We grew up outside where there weren't any adults around, and we had to resolve stuff a lot on ourselves. Nowadays, my children didn't go outside and play like normal because of situations, you know. But every time they were with children, it was under adult, some type of adult supervision. And I'm thinking that they didn't learn how to resolve a lot of issues on their own. And I just wanted your thoughts on that, and then just enjoying the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
So,
Sister Jamila,
there's a couple of things. If your child is in West Contra Costa Unified School District, there's alternative pathways to education. So if they're
in
West
Contra Costa, he's in Texas.
Okay, friends, this is what I need you to do. So in Texas, what I need you to do is look at the alternative pathways to education. If your child, you need to look into something called a 504 plan. A 504 plan is a medical. If your child is having stomach issues where they want to make sure that they can go home to use the restroom or they need to go home to have this, they also can do where she can have access or he can have access to the teacher's lounge, right? There's ways to where you can create what's necessary for your child. Each state is different, though. Each state has their own ways of doing it. So I would ask you to call your local school board member and ask your local school board member, what are the alternative pathways to education, and tell me about a 504 plan, which is a medical plan that you can use at school. Also, I would like you to investigate the fact that your child has agency. If she is telling you that this is best for her, there is a way for the socialization to still come into play. There's clubs. Even if your child is at home, she can still participate in clubs at her residential school. Check your code. Check your educational code. You have to make sure that you look through the ed code. The ed code will let you know everything that's available to you and also the district bylaws and the district handbook, parent handbook. But you have to be your child's best advocate and an educator, right? So you have to educate yourself about what can and cannot happen. Because what will happen is most school districts take the path of least resistance, right? If you don't push them, they're not going to volunteer the information. So you got to push them. I want my child in school. What does this look like? But she has these type of issues. How can you help? What can you do? And then you say, show me the policy. Because if they say we can do nothing, show me the policy. It's impossible that you can do nothing. You have to have a policy for this. Show me your health policy. Show me your policy about individual education plan. Show me your IEP policy. Show me your 504 policy. Show me the policy that has children who do half day on campus, half day off campus. What's your hybrid policy? Do you have a virtual school policy? You push them until you get some answers that are acceptable for both you, your wife, and your child. All three of you had to come to the table with this. All three of you, because she only has 2 years left, junior and senior year. So you need to come to the table with this and see how it works for all of you. I hope that answers.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Perfect. We got one more really quick. Let's see. Caller 7426.
Yes,
caller 7426, you're on the air. Well, Waleh Aslam. What's your name? And tell us where you're calling from.
Yes, Brother Muhammad.
Brother Muhammad, where are you calling from?
From the Ummah of Prophet Muhammad, by the way, of Columbus, Georgia. I just wanted to say two things right quick. One, in 1955, my principal, now I mean, we're talking about 1955 now, a Caucasian principal, predominantly called Caucasian elementary school. My character that I wasn't aware of then, but I thank Allah, I can see it was the ground floor for what I am now, a striving Muslim, you know. And he picked me up for 3 years. From my house, came and got me every morning. I'm a family, I'm number 14 in a family of 16 people. And he picked me up every day from first grade to third grade in 1955. That experience I share with my daughter now, who teaches here in Atlanta, Georgia, at an international-type school. And her degree is in early childhood, and I guess the all branches is from it. She goes to school with the concept of the life that Prophet Muhammad lived as an orphan. And from the women who took care of him and the scenarios that Allah gave to show us how to care for those who are alone. It doesn't have to be in the parents of dinner, but any time the children are alone, the adults around them should be mindful of that and look out for their needs, their comforts, and their concerns as they are being responsible for them when they're at the school. Also, as a sidebar, because of time, what you're talking about now is what our Islamic teachers need to share in continuing education off-duty staff development so that in our school, the schools of the Islamic destiny, and especially the Sister Claire Muhammad school system, you know, we miss y'all because this will help mass produce the type of servants that the public school system needs in a positive sense without denying us our development as servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, and carry that right in so we can look out for other kids who are from 5 to 6 hours a day are in a state of orphanage. They're in a state of being an orphan. And we're responsible to guidance counselor, you know, like you said, the designated teacher who you pick out as a parent to ask, do they care about your child concern while they're there? And another thing I learned from the experience of my daughter, I've seen that the religious women in her environment, you can see the different degree of compassion that they have. And you can see the women who have less religious disciplines in their life, and they trying to find it. You can see how they react with the kids. You also see
yes,
the teacher
sir.
Who
yes,
don't
sir.
Care
and
about
I,
the kids.
Sir, I don't mean, and I we appreciate your comments. I don't mean to cut you off, but
yes,
I do have to get this sister off of
yes,
here.
Yes, I know.
Because she
yes,
she got to get back, and I got one more that I got to get off.
Right.
I got to get her on
yes,
because we're back to school. Appreciate your comments. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Sister Jamila, we so appreciate you taking this time with us this morning. You are always on brand, lighting up the microphone. Always, always, always. Appreciate you.
I appreciate y'all. Thank you so much. I'm sorry I have to leave, but Honorable Suttis, please call me anytime. I'm here. I loved it. I appreciate it. I appreciate the brother's comments that he just had. It does take a village, and people have to be invested in our children. And I appreciate you so much. Y'all have a beautiful school year, and please call me back.
I will have you back.
Best,
I want to report. Yes, God willing, we want to report. We want to report from Miss Irish Abby moving in and Brown.
Absolutely. Yes,
thank
ma'am.
You.
Okay, I will talk to y'all very soon.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Bye. With that, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with Sister Aliyah Akbar talking to us from Oakland Unified School District. Let's take a quick station break and pay some bills. Do not touch that dial. Thank you so much.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Edward Willis, advisor at Graceline Community, asking you to join me in supporting community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or phone in your pledge to 910-317-0297. Again, make your tax-deductible contribution today at cwsc.us or by phone at 910-317-0297. Together, we can remake the world. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Sabrita Hadi, Director of the MCNRD Model Community National Resource Directory, reminding volunteers of our upcoming MCNRD Social Connect Conference every last Sunday of the month, 1 o'clock p.m. to 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We look forward to your participation. so please check your email for conference call information. Thank you so kindly. Assalamu alaikum.
Peace be with you and welcome to Positive Solutions to Critical Issues, hosted by yours truly, Dr. Jamal Rashid and Instructor Henry Hasid. This program is sociologically as well as psychologically inclined, with Fitler as its base. We examine the root seed to multiple effects that impact our holistic daily lives. So tune in each and every Thursday morning from 7 to 8 Eastern Standard Time here on American Muslim 360. Thank you and have a pleasant day.
Join us live every Wednesday morning from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time with host Naima Latif and yours truly, Imam Kareem Hamid, presenting The Female Solution. We look forward to your presence. Assalamu alaikum.
All right. We are back live with you, and we have two more special guests with us this morning. We have Brother Hank Roberts, and we have Sister Aliyah Akbar. Thank you so much, Sister. We are on with Sister Aliyah. She's a school psychologist with Oakland Unified School District. Sister, can you, I think I have you unmuted, and then I'm just going to unmute Brother Hank Roberts as well. I know I've had you unmuted the whole time in during the conversation, but I wanted to bring you in on this conversation about, you know, what we need to be doing to get some of these students ready. And you've heard some of the conversation about, you know, IEPs and what happens when students need to be empowered with their knowing their rights when it comes to, and parents as well, or family members as well, knowing some of their rights when it comes to some of the psychological and mental warfare that goes on in our schools and before they even step foot into the classroom. Talk to us about some of the things that you see or work doing in the classrooms to help some of these students on that front before they even get to the academic side. And welcome to the show, Madam.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sister Cheryl, for having me on. I've been working in the Oakland Unified School District for several years as a school psychologist. And I think I can just basically talk about generally how parents can prepare their kids to come to school. I'm working in the high school level, so I haven't worked in the elementary school for many, many years. But I feel as if it's really important that just like Sister Janito talked about, that they become involved in the school. It, you know, they need to go to the back-to-school night, to meet their teachers, to know who they are. And this is really important for the student because it's important to have that school-home connection because especially, you know, now that they put children in high school in ninth grade, which I think is terrible. I think they should be in middle school. But there we have ninth graders coming up into an environment where they're seeing girlfriend and boyfriends happening. They may see girls, and you know, they may see a lot of advanced relationships boys and girl relationships, and maybe they didn't see it before, and you know, just more advanced type of behavior, I believe. So I think it's important that the parents come and they make their child feel comfortable, and I think this begins with them having a nutritious meal when they come. They make sure they have breakfast, that they're not hungry, that they can focus, they can keep their attention span strong, and also they get proper sleep. A lot of times I have problems with students going to sleep in the classroom. Why is that happening? Well, you know, they're on they're on their phones to 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, on either playing games or doing something else. So it's really important that their parents really monitor that. I mean, take their phone away. They do not have to have the phone at night. What's the point? They also should make sure they go to bed at a proper time. Children need at least 8.5, 9.5 hours sleep. If you're on the phone from 1 o'clock in the morning, you got to get up at 6, you're missing a lot of rest. So,
yeah.
And this affects emotionally, right?
Yeah.
Because when you're cranky, when you don't get enough rest, you may say things, do things that to the teacher, to your peers, that get you in trouble. So it's really important that the parents really monitor their children to make sure they're getting their food, they're getting their rest, and that they can support them, in their homework as well, and help them organize their work, help them prioritize their work, what's most important. Because in high school, you have at least 7 classes that you're responsible for. You know, and you have to make sure that child can organize their subject matter where they're ready to be ready for that test when it comes. And how's that happen? I'm sorry, do you want to say something? Sorry.
Yeah, that's interesting because especially with the sleep, because I mean, there's adults who get cranky when they don't have sleep. So and
exactly.
They make bad decisions when they don't have sleep. Right? So that's an actually really good point that should not be, I mean, that needs to be underscored, the sleep context. I hear a lot of people, I mean, I'm one of those people who I never did have to have a lot of sleep, but I watch people who don't let, I mean, I let young, like elementary school children stay up late and high school children stay up late. And I'm glad you're bringing up this part about sleep. And then how about the ones who have these, this inability to have a social emotional, and Brother Hank, I'm going to have you come in on this conversation as well. So how does that affect, so the know your rights part, because I think it's really important because you, I know you deal with parents who have children on like IEPs and that part. So Sister Leah, how, as a school psychologist, because I don't think people really make that connection between, especially sleep. This one is fascinating to me. And Sister Matara, you can weigh in on this. How, the traumas that we see in the streets, the trauma that we see in, the daily lives in some of the students, and especially you're in Oakland, you're in Fed School District, how is that affecting, the students when they're coming to school? We're talking about what needs to be in your backpack other than, books and school lunch and snacks. How can we prepare these parents to be more engaged? Or why is it so important that they're engaged? Because what I see a lot is people make excuses for why they can't be, and I want to give them reasons to find excuses to be more engaged. Do you understand my query?
Yeah. Well, a lot of parents, I think it was brought up from the last speaker, they're working a lot of maybe 2 jobs, and maybe they're single parents, and it's very difficult for them to always be there when they need to be for their students. And the fact that, and you talked about the trauma, that trauma can come from their environment. A lot of times, I know when I was working at a more inner city school, I was exposed to trauma myself right there on the campus. I saw two people get shot. And so that traumatized me, and I'm just saying, wow, this is happening to me. I'm sure that, young people are also hearing gunshots at night, being traumatized by, and just hearing the gunshots alone can affect you. And I'm going to maybe bit off a little bit, but because I assess kids for their cognitive ability and also assess them, their ability to focus, trauma affects it all. I see kids who maybe come from that environment that's more impacted have lower scores than kids that don't have that type of exposure. So it's really important that the parents are sensitive to that, that they get some sort of counseling for their children to get them to talk about it, and as much as they can, give them that social emotional support themselves with getting them other activities they can get into, that they could build their self-esteem up, that they can feel that they that's not all their life, that they have other, there's other things that they can get involved with. I think it's important to get a mentor if they can, if it's possible. Mentorship is so important, especially when your parents are not there. They can be that bridge of support for the student. I mean, those are some of the things I can think that can help. But I think, if possible, the parent has to, if possible, some kind of way, get and be in touch with the teachers and the principal to let them know. I think what Sister Jamila was talking about, let them know who they are, that they are responsible. Because I have to say, I mean, I have a lot of, we have IEPs, parents don't even show up. They don't even, I mean, we'll call them, we'll multiple calls, they don't even show up. And what is that telling the student? That nobody cares. And so that gives them an even more depressed and gives them more withdrawn, and they get worse. But when they see that the parent is there, they show up, it makes a world of difference. So that's like all I can say is that we have to, as much as possible, encourage the parents to, if they can't show up, get their aunt and uncle, somebody to show up to the IEP to let this child know that they're important and what they do is cared about.
So speaking of that, Brother Hank, you run an organization called Peacemakers, and you are the chair of the NAACP California Hawaii Statewide Parent Engagement Committee. So hearing what Sister Alia just spoke of, what can we do to get parents to understand the importance, the importance, the dire need to be engaged? And the number one thing to be engaged is to show up. I mean, I get it. I understand. And everybody has said it. The parents are working, and sometimes it's just to survive. And children get caught in as collateral damage sometimes in that everyday struggle to survive. As parents, something that Jamila said still sticks with me, it's work. Just like going to your job is, parenting is work. So how do we stress that children have to be the priority? How do we get them, sir?
Well, first, it's a pleasure to be on the show, and I would really just start by saying to all parents, if you're concerned about having a 40-year-old child still living with you, then it might be real important to start determining how do you assure yourself that that doesn't happen. And I've seen that 40-year-old child within my cousins and nephews, if you will, and they're not here today. So yeah, that's a real deficit to have an adult in the same house with you, with the mindset of somebody that's 16, 17, and 18 because the homework wasn't done in school. So you're probably saying, well, okay, I hear you, but let me go to some fundamental beginnings, not just high school, which is critical, as was already stated. But in case we didn't know, African-American children, 18% of us go to the preschool. But here's what's scary. We're suspended 40% of the time. That's preschool. Before you even start talking about first grade, second grade, 40% of the time, you're already in a position to be missing school. So let's look at the infrastructure and come back to that. We have to be transparent. I mean, ever since Brown versus Board 1954, and now we're in 2023, the percentage of teachers in the public schools, 90% are white. That was then and is still now. The school administrator, same percentage. We mentioned psychologists, the same percentage, 90%. So if you look at this black child or child of color that's walking into a school, look at the dynamics that they're facing just by those who are staff. And we have to be transparent and know that implicit bias is always at the table, whether we want to admit it or not. How we've been trained as adults has a lot to do with who trained us. So let me get to the point. So when you talk about all of the different resources, tutoring and extended school hours and programs and mentors, which is all great, but the bottom line is all the research continues to show the most natural, critical, inexpensive resource is parent engagement.
Yeah.
When children are in sports, look how excited they get when they see you watching them play basketball, football, dance, or whatever. I mean, why can't they have that same excitement when they see you coming to school, especially if they're trying to avoid a 40-year-old child that lives with them? I'm going to stop there for a second because I have so much more to say.
No, I think that's exactly right. So I want to say this, and I want to get both of your reactions to this, because we talk about IEPs a lot. We've seen an uptake of ADD in children diagnosed as early as kindergarten. Children have a natural exuberance, and they have a natural energy. And it's always concerned me when I see really young children having these diagnoses that are not necessarily medical diagnoses. They're diagnosed by a school. And it's, okay, so is it that, or is they have this boundless energy? And then all of a sudden, these young black and brown boys are told that they can't do mathematics, that they cannot read. And by the third grade, when they've done really well up into third and fourth grade, then all of a sudden they can't. Is it the trauma that's going on in their communities? Is it something else that's happening? Then I watch these same young men beat the skins off of everybody in a video game. These same young men can recite everything that Kobe Bryant did or LeBron James or Steph Curry did in every game they've ever played in NBA. They can tell you their favorite player in football, every statistic that they've ever done. They can know every cheat code on their favorite video game. But you mean to tell me that this young man can't do mathematics and cannot do science? As a scientist who has done some of the hardest biochemistry formulas that is out there, who has seen people get dropped from organic chemistry because they cannot do the formulas, I can't play those video games. So you mean to tell me that we cannot teach these young men and women to be scientists, to be engineers, to get through calculus and in pre-cal? I don't buy it. I don't buy it. So I wanted to know from you, why can we not? Those are transferable skills in any other situation. How is this not transferable skill? Why are we honing this energy in on mathematics and science and those in physics and those kind of things? I would like to know.
Well, I think it has to come from the environment. I think it's really easy for someone who has a parent who's a scientist who hears the language of scientists, has the attitude of a scientist, who has the emotional stability of a scientist to maybe become a scientist. But if you are involved, if you come from an environment where there's a lot of chaos, there's a lot of, you know, drinking, smoking, and all that kind of stuff, and you're just trying to survive, I'm going to be very honest, it's very difficult for you to focus and to care about those types of things, because the video games and the music and all that other things, those things are ways for you to get away from the chaos. It's a way for you to self-medicate, if you want to say, and you end up getting smoking pot very young because you're self-medicating. So you're dealing with just a lot of trauma that keeps you away from science. Because in order for you to sit down and do that calculus and do the science, you have to have the quiet. You have to have the nurturing. You have to also have people telling you that you can do it and modeling that type of behavior. But if you don't have it, hey, it's very difficult. I'm not saying it's not impossible, but it's very difficult.
That's what I wanted to hear, is the modeling and telling you you can do it. Go ahead, Hank.
Let me speak to the possibilities of that, because I'm very honored and proud to say that I have two parents with a sixth-grade education but a PhD in love. And so wrapped in any package that we're going to be talking about children need to bring to school, that's the package that needs to be at home, is love. And because of that PhD in love, all five of us are college graduates. I moved nine times. I mean, I said a PhD in love, but remember, sixth grade education. So you already know what my childhood is like. But one of the things that my parents always did, and this is, to me, is the most important, critical first step, when you, especially now when school is starting. Why wait for a phone call for bad news? Wait for a phone call to say your son or your daughter is in trouble. They did. That's typically the kind of phone calls we get from the schools when it comes to our children. How about if you get a good start in this race and go right to the chase, meet that teacher, have your child with you, and let them know that you are a partner and you want to work with that teacher to make sure your child succeeds. And your child is listening to that and understanding now that there's a relationship that's being built between their parent and their teacher. And we have to realize also that a lot of our teachers are doing a job. They don't really care. It's a payday. But if you, the parent, and you're holding them accountable, that child that we think can't learn, all of a sudden the game changes because their parent is now involved in the process. Parent engagement is critical, and the NAACP just recently passed a resolution here in the state of California that's designed to help parents understand how to engage, how to be equipped and empowered to effectively utilize the proper skills to make sure that their child's educational outcome is positive. So I hear what's being said, but I have to say again that when parents show up, come to the table, they make a difference. The game changes, and that's a critical. And it has to be face to face. When you start exchanging phone numbers, you can call me and anytime. Let me know. You're building a relationship that will last for the rest of that school year. And that child, just from seeing that connection between their teacher and you, it will change how they react. Because now they know they have to be accountable as well. So that's a real important first step when it comes to your child being able to not live with you at the age of 40. I'll stop there.
Yeah. These tools don't come easy, and they don't come natural to some parents, as Sister Matla mentioned earlier in the last hour. So what can we do to make it, a more natural process for some parents, recognizing that, some either don't know how, don't care to know how, don't have the time to know how, and don't know what they don't know. What can we do? Because some just don't know what they don't know.
That's true. Well, I think it's important. It's, as we say, it takes a village. It's, okay, we have the parent, maybe they don't have the skills, but maybe there's a grandmother, there's an aunt, there's somebody else that could step in. Sometimes children are more closer to their aunts and uncles than they are their parents. So, having them stepping in does help. And then because I know a lot of times are intimidated by the administrators, and they, because they were once, a few years back, they were that student in high school, and they know how intimidating administrators and some teachers can be, so they maybe don't feel confident about speaking out and supporting their child. But maybe another family member can be that support. And maybe talking to that parent and asking them, okay, you know, I see that you're a little bit apprehensive about speaking out and for your child, but is there someone who could come in your place? I wouldn't hesitate to ask if I had a good relationship with that parent to ask her that. And so that's one thing.
Can I get a word in here? I think it's also important because the reality is all parents are not going to be active as we know they should be. But I think that if we look at, you know, it takes a village, I think these religious leaders in the communities, whether it's Muslim, Christian, Jewish, whatever, Buddhist, Sikh, whatever, they have to stress from the platform, the pulpit that they're speaking from, to encourage parents to take an active role in their child's education and also maybe offer support for the parents in being able to do that. And also I think from the school position, the teachers have to, we know the effect that a coach has on a child that plays on the team. You know, sometimes you'll tell your child, I want you to do this when you get on the field. No, the coach doesn't want us to do that, all right? I think that teacher has to see themselves almost in the role of a coach in coaching that child in taking charge of their educational life and opportunity. And they have to, you know, administrators have to hold teachers accountable for maintaining communication with parents before there is a problem, so that it is a two-way street. And if it isn't the parent, if it's the grandmother or the auntie or whoever, but there has to be an active communication line. You know, sometimes there's a phone number on file, but if you're never able to reach the person at the other end of that phone, it doesn't do any good. So it has to be an active communication. And then also I think civic and community organizations similar to Brother Hank's Peacemakers, that can help to provide mentors and educational advocates and parent advocates or whatever, that is another source, another stream that we can use to try and make that student a priority and to help them. And sometimes it might mean tapping into the retirement community. We got elders in the community, many retired teachers. I hear Brother Hank talking about, you know, the majority of the teachers are Caucasian. Well, the reason why the majority of teachers are Caucasian might be because African Americans are not going into the field of education as we have in the past. So maybe we have to look at alternatives to get more African Americans and Hispanic and Asian students in the field of education that can help as paraeducators, you know, resource people in the class. I just think we have to look at the whole picture. And if one thing is not working, then try to shore up other areas to work. That's all I have to say right now.
Thank you.
I wanted to piggyback off what was said. All of that is very relevant and very necessary because from what I see, we're talking about generations of exclusion, not really ever being able to be at the table, never really being trained how to be at the table. I mean, I look at, just you go back in your own history, how many times were you really, if you think about it, were really invited to the table from the beginning? It just, what just that engagement hasn't happened. So we're talking about a major paradigm shift based on a lot of what was just said. But it also brings to mind that we have to look at a big major component, and that is to bring the village to the school. That's critical. And that's where, like was said, parent mentors become critical to create that modeling of what it's like and what needs to be done for your child to be successful. Because if it's not done that way, to depend on the school to do it is highly unlikely. There's no real interest in the school going to the neighborhood, knocking on doors. That's not going to happen. So it's really important to have organizations that can mediate and bring that collaboration between the parent, the teacher, and the child, and create that accountability. That's to me is moving in the direction for change. And part of what the NAACP's goal is also what was just said, is to align ourselves with churches, with athletic programs, to get the word out in terms of what parents' rights are. And I'm going to say this and stop. So many of our parents have no clue in terms of their power. I mean, they've never heard of something called a school site council, which is a place where decisions are made on how money is spent to provide services for their child. They have no idea what that is. So that's a part of education that needs to happen to make sure that we're empowered to have a voice in how decisions are made that will affect the outcome of our children. I'll stop there.
I like that part, and there was something else that Sister Aaliyah, I wanted you to speak on before I ask you another question, is about parents not knowing, because there's two things here, not knowing about school site council and not knowing about services when they do need these type of services from a school psychologist's office. What are the kind of services that your office offers?
Well, basically, let me tell you a little bit how the process works. When there's a parent who is concerned about how a child is learning or behaving, and he reaches out to the parent, and you know they converse. They try to figure out some strategies, and then basically the teacher brings the situation to the student study team, and the teacher along with the parent sit down and they're trying to figure out some strategies to help the student. And the strategies fall through, then they say, well, maybe they're having some sort of, maybe their emotional problems need additional support, or there's maybe some learning processing problem that they're not understanding what they're hearing and they're not understanding what they're seeing. So that's when I step in. And then they refer that particular student to a case manager once an assessment plan is signed, and that assessment plan delineates all the testing that will be done to find out, well, how can we better support the student? I come in and I do my testing, and the case manager do their testing, and we come back and we sit down and we talk about the results, and then we develop what we call an individual educational plan that's specific for that student. And then the services are provided, basically whatever the team decides the best thing or best services would be for to help the student. So I'm trying to get back to your problem, I'm just telling you a little bit about the procedure of that's one way that a parent can get support. And another way, which it's sometimes a little bit more expedient, if they write a letter to the principal and say, I want my kid to be assessed. That is another way that it can be done. And then we would meet with the parent and find out what's going on. And because we have to respond within 15 days of that letter, and then we go from there.
All right. Yeah.
Can I ask a question, please?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
My question is, and all of that sounds really good, and I've sat in SSTs as well. Well, what, from your perspective, what role do parents have in voicing their decision on what they want or don't want? Do want or don't want?
from the lens of the parent.
Oh, they want or they don't want on the IEP or what they don't do they want or they don't want in the classroom. I'm not clear.
All of the above in terms of having a voice to say what they feel is best for their child in terms of what's being recommended.
It's all about what the parent wants. It's not about what the teacher wants. They have the power. They call the shots. Okay?
That's right.
We listen to the parent. And I think a lot of parents don't understand. They don't understand that they are the ones who have the power. If they don't want their kid to be a sus, they're not going to be a sus.
Yeah. I think that's what he was getting to.
They don't get it.
And that's where sometimes parents don't know they have the power. They really don't. They really don't know. They nod their heads and basically accept a lot without knowing that they can say and speak out. That's real. I'm glad you're making that point because, again, that's where being educated on your rights is critical so you'll know what power you really do have. And I'm just saying as an example, maybe what power you have is to push to make sure that your therapist is culturally competent. You know, that could be important. But if you don't know you can initiate that thought as a possibility, then you just remain silent. So I also think parent mentors are critical in this whole process as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right. And I think a lot of times when we have student study teams or even have IEP mm-hmm. meetings, mm-hmm. the student who has an advocate or someone who knows their rights,
mm-hmm.
it comes off much more effective in writing good IEPs and getting the needs of the child met better because parents are one thing the school district does not want is a lawsuit. That's just like that they run away with that. They do not want it, and they will do everything in their power to avoid it. Because that's money being taken away from the school district.
Absolutely. Well said. And I appreciate you for that transparency because that is that's a fact. So what I'm getting at and you really helping me make sense is that it's so critical, it's so important that parents are engaged and most importantly as they're engaged, they are educated on their rights, equipped to understand how to use those rights, which empowers them to know what they want and speak with confidence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I believe as that begins to have a domino effect in our communities, we will see attendance increase. We will see academic performance excel, and we will see a reduction in behavior because accountability now becomes at the front of the table for all kids.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
So we've got about a little over 10 minutes left, and so I wanted to ask, and Sister Musla, did you have another question before I ask this one?
No, I just think that in every community, and I would hope in every masjid, every church, wherever, that there is a program initiated to educate parents about their rights and their responsibilities as far as being engaged, whether it's the mother or the father or the grandmother, grandfather, auntie or uncle, whoever, that there is someone from every family assigned that responsibility to report back to the parent if it's not the parent as far as what has to happen to ensure that students' success, academic, social, and emotional success as they go through the education system.
I also wanted to add that the parent has the power to bring whoever they want to the IEP and whoever they want to the student study team, whoever they want. They have the power for that, to do that.
And they don't know.
That's important. That's important. That's important for people to know. It's also one of those things where I'm always amazed at how people get those, you know, they get those packets. So we pack our backpacks. So we just packed our backpacks. You packed the backpack, you sent your child to school. Now we've got the school supplies, and now we're giving them the social-emotional learning tools that go in the backpacks. But the other thing that's important is every year, children come home, even the big ones, the high schoolers and the college students. They come home with full backpacks after their first week of school. Now, can you give some real clear advice to parents about what they should be doing when they come home with that full backpack? Because I'm always amazed how people do not read that's coming home from school. Because you have to sign off on all them papers that you send back to the school.
Mm-hmm.
So I get it that people are busy. I get it that they say they don't know. But it's in writing. And you're signing off on it when you send it back to the school every first week of school. So, that's it. How you don't know
well,
what you're
doing. One important thing, I'm going to put this out there. You have to make sure the parents themselves can read. And mm-hmm. if they are not literate and they can't read, yeah. then there has to be a resource available to them to help them to be able to read what is coming from the school. And they may not be able to read for, you know, a whole bunch of reasons. Maybe English is not their first language. You know, maybe they didn't complete school and they have some shame around not being able to read. But I think that is one thing.
Yes.
And also, again, focus. They have to focus on, okay, this is a critical time, the beginning of the school year. Someone has to let them know during these first months or whatever period of time, look for communication from the school that you have to sign off on for your student for the school year. So there again, resources and support for the parents in their role of parenting are needed, I think.
Well, I think that's really critical what was just said, and I'll say this and put it in the context of immigrants who come to this country. Just because we're born in America does not mean that we have all of the knowledge and all of the understandings and we all should be speaking English and we all are, because that's not true. Many of our parents are on the same level in many respects to understanding reading and writing as if they were immigrants. So it's
right.
unfortunate that I have to put it in that context, but that's a reality. And so we do need to support them. We do need to make sure that they don't have to face the embarrassment of not knowing how or wanting people to know that they can't read. I mean, generational deficits in education is almost a norm in who we are. And so we have to treat this as if our people are reaching out but don't know how, and we need to step in and help them to know how to navigate. That's critical, what was just said. I'll stop there.
Okay. Anyone else? So how do you do that, though?
Well, that's what I was saying
before. We've heard this before, that some people, and so sometimes the children are the ones who are signing off on the documents, so the parents don't even know. I go back to saying before, they don't know what they
right.
don't know. So how do we
right.
close that gap between they don't know what they don't know, and we've heard, I've mentored children in West Contra Costa School District who have just flat out told me that they've signed off on the paperwork because their parents can't read or understand it. And these are Spanish-speaking right. and English-speaking children
mm-hmm.
whose parents just
mm-hmm.
don't read.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we get to them?
And what I was saying earlier, and it's magnifying itself the more as we think about it, we need parent mentors. We need parent advocates, folks that are culturally competent in understanding the parents that they're working with, and there's no shame, there's no embarrassment, there's care, love, and concern. That needs to be at the forefront. There's a lot of parent advocacy in, and I'm just going to be real transparent, in terms of the white community, but it's not that much in everybody else's community. And that's part of what the NAACP movement is about, is to create that window of opportunity so that the advocacy can be initiated as soon as possible.
Thank you. And
here on campus, there are organizations that work specifically for the Hispanic community. And you were talking about the school, we said the school site committee. A lot of Hispanic parents are on there making sure that their kids' needs are being met. But
that's
also we have an organization that works with newcomers. These are Hispanic children who come from countries that have been war-torn, and, they're the ones who are trying to get over the border, they're trying to get over here and all that kind of stuff. A lot of them don't know any English at all, and they're, 15, 16 years old? So they have, we have an advocate here to help them navigate here on site. So they're not completely alone.
I'm so glad you said that, because if you think about everything you just said, why isn't it happening for us? Because we don't know. The folks that do know, they're not sharing. They're strictly looking out for their own needs. So we have to step up and do
the same.
It's the reality check that has to happen. We really have to. I mean, what you're saying to me, we should be ahead of the game. We've bested in this country. We helped build this country, and we still are treated like second class citizens. It's because power is knowledge. Knowledge is power.
I do think it's important to note what both you and Sister Matla said earlier, is that it is much easier to see language barriers than it when language is looked at as a foreign language than it is to see someone who English is supposed to be a first language and not understand that you can be illiterate in your first language. And I think that's kind of it. Well, good people, we've come to the end of our program, a wonderful program, but we could talk for another hour on this because it is such an important topic. Thank you so much for your insight today in helping us get parents prepared to go back to school. Sister, you have about 30 seconds, Sister Amatala. I'm going to give you 30 seconds if you want to say something really quick before I close us out.
I wanted to make a quick thing to Brother Ishmael, who was asking about the homeschooling. What the sister was saying about the alternative path for the social component, definitely clubs can make up that. Outside activities, chess clubs, athletic clubs, soccer, basketball, whatever, tennis, golf, those things are good to make up for the deficit. And I thank Brother Hank for his contribution, and Sister Lee and Sister Jamila. I think that this is really needed information, and I challenge in the Muslim community, the imams to come to the table and set up committees that help, especially if you don't have a Clara Muhammad school in your location. We know you should be working towards that, but if you don't have one, you have to set up some kind of support system for those students who are in the public school. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and we appreciate you guys. Thank you so much. We'll have you back again. Remember, life is all about perspective. Change how you look at things, and the things you will look at will also change. Use words that work. Not what you say, it's what the people hear and feel. And stay and remember that we have the power to make a difference and to make a change, and stay powerful, stay purpose-driven, stay prayerful, stay politically engaged, and remember to participate civically. We appreciate you. We'll see you back here. Same time, channel next week, inshallah. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Have a wonderful week. Have a wonderful day. Assalamu alaikum. Masalama. That's a wrap.